Last week at the G8 summit in Japan, the new superpower kid on the block, Russia's Dmitry Medvedev, crossed paths with the soon-departing President Bush.
NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore.
In an exchange of courtesies, the Russian called our president George, and Mr. Bush praised Medvedev as smart. It was their way of marking time until a new American president comes along. 2 months after being installed by his mentor, Vladimir Putin, Medvedev has yet to give any indication of how much he will be the puppet, how much the innovator. So far, he has stuck close to the Putin line. Like Putin, he supports six-party talks on North Korea's nuclear program, and he joins in the international effort to induce Iran to give up its nuclear weapons aspirations. But in the long-standing Russian tradition of siding with countries liberated from colonialism, he has joined with China in vetoing United Nations sanctions against Zimbabwe. Like Putin, he's a hardliner on Russian security, and equally willing to use the oil weapon as an instrument of pressure. As Putin, in 2006, closed the pipeline to Lithuania and shut off natural gas to Ukraine for 3 days to counter pro-Western actions. So now Russia last week reduced the flow of oil to the Czech Republic when the Prague government signed an agreement with the United States to deploy the tracking radar for a missile defense system. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been in Moscow recently talking, he said, to leading political personalities whom he did not name. In an article in the Washington Post, the father of détente with the Soviet Union now reports his impression that a new phase of Russian politics is underway, which may lead to some kind of redistribution of power. He adds that a Russian democracy is not preordained, of course, but he urges the Bush administration and the presidential candidates to give Russia a chance and to restrain public comments. Once again, as often in the past, America's veteran diplomat seems to see openings for accommodation, and one awaits with interest the emergence of a new and friendly Russia that is not immediately evident to other scholars of Russia's evolution. This is Daniel Shore.
And this is NPR, National Public Radio. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Wall Street and Main Street are nervously watching banks today. Investors have been spooked by failing bank stocks, and customers are wondering if their money is safe. Lines of them outside the failed IndyMac Bank for a second straight day certainly didn't help. IndyMac was taken over by the FDIC, and in a moment we'll talk with the head of the FDIC about how much of your money is and isn't insured by the federal government. First, to NPR's Chris Arnold, who reports on how likely it is that more banks could fail.
One place that you can see firsthand the problems facing banks around the country is at the trading floor at a company called DebtX in Boston. The company is sort of like a stock exchange, except instead of stocks, it helps banks sell off loans, good, bad, and ugly ones, so that they can raise money.
These guys down here are the ones who are talking to the bank clients, trying to help them figure out what loans they might be able to move at a price that would work.
Kingsley Greenland is DebtX's CEO. All the problems the banks are facing mean big business for him. He's helped hundreds of banks sell off billions of dollars worth of loans over the past year.
It's busier than we've ever seen it. Yeah, I mean, I think you can reasonably say that at least the volume that we're selling is at least 200% more than this time last year.
Greenland says a lot of regional banks made the same mistake. They couldn't make as much money on things like credit cards, so they looked to make money from real estate. Then the housing market tanked, and lots of construction projects that banks financed went bad. Now, to clean up their books, the banks have to sell off those loans and take a loss.
For many of those, the value in a marketplace right now could be 50 cents on the original dollar. Some instances even less if they're in very remote areas.
Beyond housing, falling values of commercial properties like shopping malls can force banks to raise more money. That's hard to do when investors are dumping your stock and running in the other direction. Greenland says a lot of banks are getting squeezed.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about it. I don't see a massive SNL-type debacle, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to be painful.
But just how many banks are in such serious trouble that they're going to go under is hard to know.
We're still in the midst of a giant guessing game.
Chris Thornburg is a forecaster with Beacon Economics. He says there are just too many question marks: how bad the housing crunch will be, what the broader economy will do, and which banks are still heavily exposed to bad loans. He says the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, actually has a list of troubled banks that it's keeping an eye on. There are more than 90 banks on the list right now, but it turns out it's a secret list.
The problem here is this: is here is a situation in which information is both an enemy and a friend. The FDIC recognizes that if they point at a bank and say, well, maybe them, they can create a full-fledged panic and bring down even healthy institutions.
But not knowing which banks are most in trouble is also helping to create this panic across the whole industry. At one point today, the stock of the Ohio-based bank National City was down more than 75% on the year. Washington Mutual and Wachovia have also been falling sharply. But some analysts think investors are getting too scared.
My sense of it is that it's not a system-wide problem.
Brian Bethune is an economist with Global Insight. He says more banks will fail over the next couple of years, but he thinks most banks are on much more solid footing than, say, IndyMac Bank, which just went bust a few days ago.
Well, IndyMac was a specialized mortgage lender and therefore had a lot of concentration in the mortgage market. Large regional banks, they're not anywhere near as exposed.
Regulators are trying to calm fears. They say most banks will be fine and most people are covered by FDIC insurance. The main concern for most people is that the ongoing problems in the banking system could make it harder to borrow money, and that could keep dragging down the economy. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Here it is, the 16th of July, and the presidential election is already decided. We don't know who's going to win, but we do know whoever wins will certainly be left-handed. In fact, a large number of American presidents lean to the left, even when they did not, in politics. Commentator Frank DeFord explains that lefties do more than make great leaders. They also fill sports halls of fame.
If you're interested in having your son support you in your old age, here is my vocational advice to you. Starting when he's in the crib, turn him into a left-hander and then train him to become a relief pitcher. There's always a well-paying place for layabout southpaw relievers well up into their athletic dotage. You see, while lefties moan that the world at large discriminates against them, our sinister brethren have all the advantages in sports whenever they directly face right-handers. And now an engineering professor named David Peters has come up with some basic statistics which show what we righties always knew anyway, that baseball in particular is a gauche paradise, and that ain't no left-handed compliment. Whereas only about 10% of the whole human population is lefty, Professor Peters revealed that about 25% of major leaguers are the minority-handed sort of people. More significant, in the Hall of Fame, of the 70 pitchers, 15 were southpaw, more than twice the Homo sapiens average, and hitters. Of the 138 in Cooperstown, 59 were lefty and 8 more half-lefty switch hitters. That means that an incredible 46% of the best hitters ever swung at those appetizing right-handed slants. In basketball, left-handed shooters have always driven opponents crazy. The game's greatest defensive player, Bill Russell, was a southpaw, which meant that his strong arm matched perfectly for blocking right-handers' shots. In tennis, the ball spins differently off a left-hander's racket. Hello, Rafael Nadal. Roger Federer's shots that go to a fellow right-hander's weakness bounce right into Nadal's wheelhouse. Just as a statistically unusual number of baseball's greatest hitters, Cobb, Ruth, Williams, Gwynn, Bonds, were left-handed, so does Nadal come from distinguished lefty lineage. Laver, McEnroe, Connors, Navratilova. Somebody once wrote that John McEnroe would be just another losing quarterfinalist if he were right-handed. McEnroe was furious. Of course, if there'd been a fight, he surely would have battered the writer. Left-handed boxers are a scourge other fighters try to avoid. In fact, there's a theory postulated by two French sociologists at the University of Montpellier that lefties succeed so in sport because back when men faced off in man-to-man combat, lefties prevailed more often, living to pass those victorious genes on. The best proof that lefties have an advantage in man-to-man competition comes conversely from golf, where you're not playing your opponent, only that neutral little ball. In the whole history of the PGA, left-handers have only won 37 tournaments, and Phil Mickelson has personally accounted for more than half of them. Mickelson might have won even more if he didn't make so many ditzy decisions. But then, of course, as us in the smug right-handed majority are so sure of in defeat, left-handers may have the advantage in sport, but God evened that out by making them goofier.
Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
On Friday, Batman returns. Again. The Dark Knight once again stars Christian Bale as the Cape Crusader, along with the late Heath Ledger as the Joker.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Commentator John Ridley says this new Batman film marks the latest round in another epic battle between two comic book titans.
There are two kinds of people in the world. I'm not talking Mac people or PC people or even red staters, blue staters. Whether you know it or not, in this life, you are either a DC Comics person or a Marvel Comics person. DC Comics are the publishers of the mythic icons of superdom. Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman. It's for people who like their heroes majestic and inspiring. And for folks who like their heroes all angsty and barely able to get off the analyst couch to save a cat from a tree, there's Marvel Comics, home to heroes like Spider-Man and the Hulk. Arguments about which is the better superhero universe are heated at comic book shops, but in filmed entertainment, historically, one publisher was the clear victor.
Gentlemen, this man needs help.
Until the mid-90s, the multiplex was the domain of DC Comics. And in my far from humble opinion, 1978 Superman is still the comic book adaptation by which others are measured.
Well, I certainly hope this little incident hasn't put you off flying, miss. Statistically speaking, of course, it's still the safest way to travel.
Right.
Marvel Comics, on the other hand, could barely stay solvent, let alone get movies made. The company was mercilessly transferred from one owner to the next, like last month's non-Mylar bag issue. But like any good story, there's a plot twist. On the DC side, the once mighty Superman franchise petered out, and the Batman franchise devolved into camp like the 1960s television series. Meanwhile, with Gamma Strength, Marvel got its financial house together and built up its brand. Over the last 8 years, films based on Marvel characters have raked in an average of $400 million at the box office.
I'm worried about you.
I don't need your help.
Everybody needs help sometimes, Peter. Even Spider-Man.
And the Marvel Universe also lends itself to modern storytelling. DC Comics are set in make-believe cities like Metropolis and Gotham. The Marvel heroes reside in alt versions of New York and Los Angeles. They have personality issues set against real-world stories. Iron Man is a weapons technology billionaire who has to deal with his own guilt over bloodshed in Afghanistan.
They say the best weapon is one you never have to fire. I prefer the weapon you only need to fire once.
That mix of fantasy and reality seems to resonate more with audiences in our post-9/11, post-Iraq invasion world. Iron Man is currently the summer's highest-grossing movie. But for all you non-true believers out there, DC is hardly down for the count. Following the successful reboot of the Batman franchise, the eagerly anticipated Dark Knight hits theaters Friday. Can the Caped Crusader single-handedly rescue the DC Universe and return it to its glory days? To quote the comics, to be continued.
Screenwriter John Ridley. And full disclosure here, he occasionally writes for an imprint of DC Comics called Wildstorm. Ridley's blog, Visible Man, is at npr.org/visibleman. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.